Case number 16-1195 et al. American Rivers et al. Petitioners versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission et al. Ms. Wynn for the petitioners, Mr. Vishwanathan for respondent FERC, Mr. Brabender for respondent Department of Interior.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Megan Nguyen. I'm here today on behalf of American Rivers and Alabama Rivers Alliance. This case concerns a license for the operation of 7 hydroelectric dams on the Coosa River in Alabama. The dams span nearly 275 miles. That's almost the entire length of the Coosa River. Now, the Coosa is an incredibly biodiverse river, but it's also an incredibly vulnerable one. Since the construction of these dams, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the river, quote, has experienced one of the largest extinction rates in North America. Many of the species that remain are on the brink of extinction. The project area alone is home to numerous threatened and endangered species. And that is why it is so critical that the agencies follow the correct procedures and make a fully informed decision here, because the terms of this license will continue through at least 2043. I plan to address two arguments today. First, the Commission violated NEPA by failing to prepare an environmental impact statement for a project that will have significant...
I'd like to hear just a little bit about jurisdiction on this case first. The intervener raises a serious jurisdictional question as to whether we have jurisdiction over the matters decided in the first rehearing. You were rather dismissive of that in your brief. First, that it's untimely, which my understanding of jurisdictional objections is they can be raised at any time. Is there some sense that that doesn't apply in this kind of case? Or?
No, Your Honor. I think the primary argument that we intended to make in our brief was, first, that the petition wasn't incurably premature.
The intervener has raised a jurisdictional objection.
Correct.
That objection is that you did not preserve the issues from rehearing number one in your petition for rehearing number two. Before you get to that, if it's a jurisdictional objection, it can't be untimely, can it? We could hear it today if it were raised for the first time, couldn't we?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so forget the untimely. Now, their objection goes on to say that the petition that you filed with reference to rehearing number one was incurably premature. You did not reiterate that issue in petition number two, or the petition for review before us, number two. Why aren't they correct that we don't have jurisdiction over the first rehearing?
I think there's three reasons here. First, we disagree that the first petition was incurably premature. What we were trying to do there was follow this court's directive in Smith Lake. But second, even if the first petition were incurably premature under the intervision case, which is what Alabama Power cited in their brief, an inexact or mistaken specification of the order on review is not fatal, so long as petitioner's intent was clear. And one of the ways that intervision says petitioner's intent can be made clear is through contemporaneous or near contemporaneous filings.
I looked at your joint petition for review, and it says nothing about the issues. All it seems to be bringing before us is review of the order denying rehearing 156F FERC 61171, which is the second rehearing order, and the Fish and Wildlife Service biological opinion. It doesn't say anything at all about the first rehearing. So how can we infer that you were bringing before us in the second petition? I understand you say the first petition was not incurably premature, but assume that I disagree with you, or we disagree with you on that. How do you have anything before us other than what's recited in your petition for review in 16-1336?
Because Intravision guides us that this court is permitted to look at contemporaneous or near contemporaneous filings to show petitioner's intent. Here we filed a motion to consolidate the first and second petitions for review almost immediately after filing our second petition for review. And in that, we made clear exactly what we were seeking to review and why we structured our filings the way we did, because we wanted to make sure that we had that first petition for review given this court's order in Smith Lake, because this is an order that, or this is a license order that goes through 2043, and we wanted to make extra clear that we were not missing our opportunity for judicial review like the petitioners did in Smith Lake.
If you had made extra clear, you could have put both rehearing orders in your petition in 1336, couldn't you?
Yes, and because we already had a petition for review of the first, we thought that the more proper course was to move to consolidate. Other near contemporaneous filings that the court can look to under Intravision are the docketing statement that specified that we were seeking review of the license order. Also, the certificate as to parties, rulings, and related cases that specified that we were seeking review of the license order. The docketing statement.
And you had the first petition for review, which was still at that point, it was still docketed, right?
The first petition for review was still docketed. And that there had been a motion to dismiss. And we had made clear why we filed that when we did. And so, again, the key under Intravision is it's a mistaken specification of the order on review isn't fatal so long as petitioner's intent was clear. I think here our intent was very clear from the motion to consolidate that was filed after the second petition for review, from that docketing statement, from the first petition for review. But the third point is, even if this court finds that those filings didn't adequately show intent, the petitioners properly incorporated all of our arguments in our second petition for rehearing before FERC. And not only did we incorporate those arguments in FERC's second rehearing order, they acknowledged that we had incorporated those arguments. This is in footnote 7 of their rehearing order at JA 571 to 572. They acknowledged that we had incorporated those arguments, and they summarily denied those arguments that were made in our first petition for review. And they cited to the section of their first rehearing order on why they had denied those. So I think for any of those three reasons here, the court has jurisdiction. So moving on to the merits, the first issue I want to address is the NEPA issue. And as this court is well aware, under NEPA, if any significant environmental impacts might result from the proposed agency action, then an EIS must be prepared. And if the commission doesn't prepare an EIS, it must make a convincing case for why it determined the project would have no significant impact. The NEPA regulations lay out several factors to be considered in evaluating significance. We walked through several of those in our brief, but I want to focus on just a couple this morning. First, does the license have impacts that may be either beneficial or adverse? And I want to talk about three points here because I think they are crucial to understanding the long-term impacts of this license. The first is the dissolved oxygen standard allowed under the license. And dissolved oxygen just means how much oxygen there is in the water. And it is an essential measure of biological health, which none of the parties here dispute, because aquatic species need oxygen just in the same way that terrestrial species do to survive and grow and reproduce. Here, the license sets a 4.0 milligrams per liter standard during generation, but it places absolutely no restrictions on dissolved oxygen during non-generation. And to put that in some context, if you look at the license at the Logan Martin development, for example, the generation period that the license talks about is only 1 to 6 hours per day. So that means non-generation is the majority of this time. That's a Joint Appendix 14. And the dissolved oxygen studies have shown that dissolved oxygen is below that 4.0 milligrams per liter standard 55% of the time during non-generation. So that is a lot of the time that you were having dissolved oxygen drop below 4.0 milligrams per liter. Now, the commission states
in the... how far below it drops? Does the record show how far below it drops?
I don't have that in front of me. It varies from day to day, but I can get you a record site.
I didn't know if there was there was sort of an extreme low or a range of... I assume it's obviously not constant, but I wasn't sure how wide that range below 4 even was.
It is a range, and it varies by day, but I will, and I don't have that in front of me, but I'll get you a response on rebuttal. But I can say that at Joint Appendix 499, it talks about the fact that 4 of these dams go below 4.0 on a daily basis, at least for that study period. Now, the commission states in the environmental assessment and in their brief that 4.0 milligrams per liter is the accepted minimum for federal agencies. But that entirely ignores what some of these federal agencies and as well as concerned scientists have actually said about this. And I think this is one area where they failed to take the hard look required under NEPA. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who is the agency that is statutorily mandated to ensure the continued survival of the endangered species in this river, in their 2005 comments on the draft environmental assessment, they advocated for a 5.0 minimum during generation. That's at Joint Appendix 635. And in the biological opinion, they said that the failure to address dissolved oxygen during non-discharge periods is a, quote, major concern, since it does not consider that the biological needs of fish and mollusks must still be met when a hydroelectric project is not generating. So Fish and Wildlife has called this a major concern. The EPA has said, quote, based on the potential biological effects of sub 5.0 milligrams per liter dissolved oxygen concentration to fishes and aquatic invertebrates, it seems clear that low dissolved oxygen concentrations in many of the facility's tailwaters during non-generation periods impact the abilities of fishes, mussels, snails, and other aquatic animals from using these habitats. And they go on to say, this is an unreasonable disturbance, given the fact that the waters should serve multiple purposes, including enhancing fish and wildlife. And that was on their comments to Alabama's water quality standards at Joint Appendix 1355.
What did FERC say about why it couldn't require maintenance of at least the 4 ml level during non-generation? Did they say it was economically infeasible, that it would have its own adverse environmental effects, that it wasn't technically feasible? What reason did they give?
Well, they very much gloss over this. One reason that they give is because they say that 4.0 is the accepted minimum standard among federal and state agencies. I think those quotes from the federal agencies show that that's not necessarily the case. It is true that Alabama has a 4.0 standard, but I think what's important to remember about that 4.0 standard is that is a carve-out for existing hydroelectric utilities in the state of Alabama. Every other water user in the state has to meet a 5.0 milligrams per liter standard.
So what you're saying is that the only reason FERC gave was that we don't have to because that's what state law says.
And they also mentioned that as a reason for not requiring it during non-generation, because some of these technologies only apply during generation. But in response to that, there are dams all over the country that meet these standards during non-generation, and there are technologies that would allow them to meet the standard during non-generation.
Alabama Power Company said it was going to use, and I forget what the formal name was they gave, but a diffuser system. And FERC noted that. What they said when they set reference that, is that a known entity? Is that a specific, the language they used about the title that, or label they gave for the diffuser system, is that just one thing that everyone knows what it is, or is it a type of technology that can come in many different forms and many different levels of efficiency and operation and maybe different applications for amounts of water or things like that? I just don't know much about diffusers.
So they did talk about the fact that they were going to consider turbine aeration here, but what Your Honor has pointed out is one of the major flaws with that. They didn't provide any details of the system. They didn't provide how it would be effective at these particular dams. And so the efficiency of those mitigation measures, we really don't know what that would be. And the other problem there is these mitigation measures that they talk about are only designed to bring or only required under the license to bring that dissolved oxygen standard up to the 4.0 level. And so they mentioned the possibility that it could bring it up higher, but the point is the license doesn't require it to go up higher. What the license requires is a 4.0 standard, and it doesn't require any standard during non-generation.
But I thought FERC had said, well, there's another dam a little bit away that uses one of these, and it sounded like it operates kind of like my heating system at my home. I set it on 70, and it'll push it up to 72, and then it'll cool down to 68, and it'll kick in. It just tries to keep within a range. Is that how diffusers work, or are they actually able to keep it at essentially 4.0 at a constant level? We don't know.
I specifically don't know the details of the technology. Certainly one of the points that they argue is that if you raise that dissolved oxygen level enough during generation, that then during non-generation, the dissolved oxygen level will come up as well. And certainly there are places around the country where they have effectively used aeration turbines, other mitigation measures to raise dissolved oxygen. And again, the problem is it's not what the license requires here. And we have no assurance in the license that this will be done. So one of the big points that we make is that this is what NEPA requires to be done before the federal action is taken, before the license is extended, because what we need to know here is that that will work and that will bring the dissolved oxygen level up to a level that is safe for these endangered species, that will promote the ecological health of the river. And when the studies are not done until after you have a license that's in place until 2043, it really does no good to look at those issues after they have already set the dissolved oxygen standard at the very low level of 4.0.
And would you, because you're already spent your time here, but would you be able to address what I thought was one of the main points of contention here, and that is in assessing cumulative effects or even just measuring what the environmental consequences of relicensing are, what is the baseline? What is the role of past harm and damage in that analysis?
For the cumulative impacts analysis, it is absolutely crucial that they look at the past harm. And here, I think it is very instructive because this is a river where the Fish and Wildlife Service, as I mentioned, has acknowledged that it is one of the largest extinction rates in 20th century North America, with the extinction or extirpation of nearly 40 species. And so it's critical that they look at that as part of the cumulative impacts. But I think where their baseline analysis breaks down is that they say, because of the baseline, we don't have to consider any of these impacts going forward because the stream already doesn't, or the river already doesn't have minimum flows, the river already has low dissolved oxygen, so these aren't new impacts that we need to consider going forward. And
why isn't that correct? If it's already the situation, how can it be part of the impact of this project?
Because the purpose of relicensing isn't simply the continuation of the status quo. It is a full reconsideration of the operation of these dams going forward. And one of the reasons for that is that many of these dams were originally licensed somewhere in the 1920s, somewhere in 1957, and the law has changed tremendously since then. We've passed the Endangered Species Act, the NEPA, the 1987 amendments to the Federal Power Act.
But that also doesn't mean we can take those, environmental impact, the ESA, all these other acts, and read them retroactively to apply to the dam that was built in 1957.
We're not asking that they be read.
You have to start with some baseline when you're getting the impact of the new project or the new act by the government. So why wouldn't that be part of the baseline we're talking about? We're not studying all the impacts that everything that happened in the world history has happened on that river. We're talking about what is the impact of this government action, aren't we?
Correct, and I'll take your question in two parts. First, we're not asking for these acts to be applied retroactively. What we're asking for them to be applied moving forward, for this license that is going to be an impact for the next 30 years. And I think this court has acknowledged this in the City of Tacoma case. The court said, quote, FERC not only has the authority but also the obligation to evaluate existing projects completely anew upon expiration of their license terms.
So are we talking about the cumulative impacts part of the analysis under NEPA? Are we talking about the biological opinion issued by FWS? Are we talking about both? And because it seems like this question about how you determine the baseline is germane to both.
Yes.
And
it may not be the same for both.
I'm sorry?
May not be the same for both.
It's not may not, but it's germane to both. Right. May not be precisely the same for both. But you're talking about all of that together?
I was intending to talk about it in the context of NEPA, but I would be happy to discuss it in the context of the Endangered Species Act as well. Because I think the baseline.
Cumulative, I just want to make clear that I know what we're talking about, so would you mind doing cumulative impacts first and then giving me a signal when you're doing biological opinion?
Absolutely. Okay. And so the cumulative impacts, I want to separate that a little. Cumulative impacts under NEPA, I want to separate that slightly from the baseline issue under NEPA. Cumulative impacts, yes, you have to look at the past, but the baseline issue, I think that the Commission and Alabama Power have tried to use this baseline issue to say we don't have to consider the impacts of these dams going forward, and that's just not the case. It's not what this court said in City of Tacoma when they required the Commission to consider impacts moving forward completely anew. We cite some other case law in our brief as to that, and so I think the distinction here is that the existence of the dams are part of the baseline. We recognize that. But the operation of those dams moving forward, what the dissolved oxygen level should be for the next 30 years, whether there should be fish passage for the next 30 years, whether there should be minimum flows for the next 30 years, these are all parts of effects of the action. They were affirmative decisions that were made in this license to select what should be going, select what should be done moving forward for the next three decades, and that has to be considered as effects of the action.
I'm not asking you to give up anything, but the question I'm about to ask you, and it may sound like it, even if we don't agree with you on this point, it's still possible for the Fish and Wildlife Service to have been arbitrary and capricious in their decision, is it not?
Absolutely. Because I think, again, the Fish and Wildlife Service, going on to the Endangered Species Act claim, first, the baseline issue is slightly different under the Endangered Species Act. There is actually direction in the consultation handbook for the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Even if we disagree on the baseline, you're not conceding that there's an adequate explanation or connection between what they have to say about incidental take and their conclusion that it isn't going to be violative of the ESA. Would that?
That's correct, because I think that this incidental take statement is done even under an inadequate baseline analysis. Yeah. And so even this incidental take statement done under what they contend the environmental baseline should be is arbitrary and capricious. It just doesn't connect the impacts that they find to the conclusions that they reach.
Can you give us your synopsis on the baseline under the biological opinion part of it?
Absolutely. So the baseline issue there, there's actually a specific section of the handbook that talks about baseline there. And what it says within effects of the action, it says, quote, under the Federal Power Act, FERC issues new licenses for existing hydropower projects as the original licenses expire. FERC has determined that these new licenses represent a new commitment of resources. Therefore, a Section 7 analysis of the project's effect on listed species is done as the same way as new projects. So I think the result you reach is somewhat the same. It's just the law you use in getting there is different because you're looking at the consultation handbook as opposed to the case law under NEPA. But I think the point is, again, the operation of these dams can be considered in that baseline, but how they are going to be operated for the next 30 years is very much part of the effects of this action, because that's going to continue to have impacts on these species that are not part of the past impacts. Or
can you draw a distinction between the effect on the species and the condition that's creating the effect? So to be a little more concrete, if you look at DO levels, the oxygen levels, so under the existing state of affairs, it sets forth some plan for DO levels. And so one way to look at it would be to say that you assume that those stay in effect, and you assume that those stay in effect going forward, so we're only talking about the future, we're not talking about the past, we eliminate the issue of retroactivity, we're only talking about the future. But in talking about the future, we're assuming that the DO levels that are in place as a result of existing measures remain in place. So you put that as part of the baseline. But then the effect on the species, as the future effect on the species of the consequence of that, wouldn't be part of the baseline. That would be something that you'd have to consider as an effect. Because it sounds to me like your argument is that the going forward DO levels are also part of the effects, not part of the baseline. And I guess what I'm suggesting is that maybe one could draw a distinction between the going forward DO levels under the existing state of affairs, assume that that's part of the baseline, but then still say that the consequence of that for species has to be considered as effects. Is that making sense, or am I conceptually?
Well, our position is that the DO levels going forward are part of the effects of the action. And here's the reason we say that, because both the whether you're looking at this under NEPA or whether you're looking at this under the Endangered Species Act, and whether you're relying on City of Tacoma or whether you're relying on the consultation handbook, it's very clear that the purpose of relicensing can't be to continue the status quo. The discretionary impacts of relicensing have to be evaluated completely anew. So that affirmative decision to say, going forward, we're going to set a 4.0 dissolved oxygen level, that is not part of the baseline. That is a decision that is going to impact these dams for the next, or this river for the next 30 years. And so that is part of the effects of the action under the Endangered Species Act, and it's a significant impact under NEPA. So we don't think those ongoing operations of the dams fall into the baseline.
Into the baseline. Okay,
but that said, with the cumulative impacts analysis under NEPA and with the required baseline analysis under the Endangered Species Act, what is very clear is that you have to consider them somewhere. And so we don't agree they should be considered as part of the baseline, but as a very last resort, they at least need to be considered as part of the baseline, and that wasn't even done here.
Can I ask you quickly on the biological opinion that, at least just as to the shoreline management plan, so a new Fish and Wildlife Service biological opinion came out and in 2015, and the service mentions that in this brief, and I didn't see anything in your reply. So as to that particular aspect, are your objections moot now by this new biological opinion?
I don't believe they are, because that biological opinion was not triggered by reopening or reinitiating, and I believe it deals with an additional population of one of these species that may have been found. So I don't think our objections to the portion of the incidental take statement that relate to the shoreline management plan are moot, but in any event, I think our objections to all other portions of the incidental take statement are.
Part of your argument was that we didn't know what the trigger was going to be for knowing that you exceeded the incidental take, and the new opinion had more specific habitat markers. So why wouldn't that cover your initial objection?
Yes, and I apologize, Your Honor. I don't have that directly in front of me, but
you didn't say anything in reply, Bruce, so I guess I wasn't. I had assumed that you no longer contest that. And this is a big case, and that's a small corner of it. But if it's no longer contested, that's important for us to know.
Contest that, and more importantly, I think the bulk of our complaints about the incidental take statement involve other portions of the incidental take statement, and are still very much in effect here.
Thank you. Here from FERC.
Good morning. Anand Viswanathan on behalf of the Commission. So I can start just briefly with, I think, the first question from Judge Santel on jurisdiction. We pointed this out in our brief. We agree that the first petition for review was incurably premature, and that's the case regardless of whether the second rehearing request was required or not. Our position that we stated in our brief was that in light of the second petition for review being timely and the fact that the petitioners moved to consolidate the petitions, we didn't see any practical effect to dismissing the first petition. On the merits, Judge Millett, you asked the question about FERC's reasons for not having a standard during periods when the project is not generating electricity. What the Commission said there is that the need for additional measures when the project's not generating would depend in part on how successful Alabama Power was in raising dissolved oxygen levels when the project was generating electricity.
So isn't that, just in stating it, quite a problem? Because you didn't know what they were going to do, just saying we'll do some kind of aeration diffuser system. You didn't even know it. You said come back in 6 months and tell me what your proposal is, 6 months after you license this plan, and take 18 months to implement it. So it's even 2 years before anything's going to start. You didn't analyze the impact for those 2 years. But how can you say we're not worried about it because they tell us they have a plan and we'll figure out what that plan is going forward? And by the way, what happens if they come back with a plan that you don't approve, but you've already licensed it? I just don't understand how that answer is remotely sufficient.
Well, I think that what the commission did say in one of its orders was that it did have experience with these kinds of diffuser systems. I think they're called four-bay oxygen mm-hmm. diffuser systems, and that they've been successful in other projects in raising dissolved oxygen levels.
But you didn't say whether those other projects were anything like this project, which is just a series of sort of captured, confined environments as you go down this river. You gave no details on what it did. You said, well, we think it got up to 6.0 and then dissipated. We didn't say how often it did that, how it dissipated, whether conditions are remotely similar to these. So how is saying I've heard of one of those things remotely sufficient? Again, and you didn't even have a proposal from Alabama Power. You gave them 6 months to come back with the proposal. And yet you're hinging everything on that.
Well, respectfully, I think the commission did say more than that it's had some experience. It said that this specific licensee has had success in raising dissolved oxygen levels using this kind of system. So we've
then
seen...
Then say, give me a proposal right now before I license this, and you show me that the fact that it was successful somewhere else matters here because the conditions are at all comparable and that you're going to do the same thing. And don't show me that it got up to 6.0 for a bit without showing me how rapidly it dissipated. What, isn't that what agencies are supposed to do?
Well, I think what the agency is supposed to do is that, at least under NEPA, it's supposed to adequately identify and evaluate the various environmental concerns. I think the commission's record reflects that it tried to do that here. With respect to dissolved oxygen, the commission has required in other licenses these kinds of provisions where the licensee comes back to the commission with more details about some particular aspect of the proposal in the past, and that's something this court's approved in the past.
I assume it would depend on what else was also baked into it. If it's one thing if that's basically the only protection that's in place, it's another thing if it's supplemental to all sorts of other stuff.
Yeah, and I think that that's a good point because the commission also pointed out that the dissolved oxygen levels were not being enhanced here simply by the use of the diffuser systems or the aeration systems. It was also by other aspects of the license. For example, the what's known as the adaptive management plans with respect to several of the developments where they would have to essentially improve their water flow to mimic a more natural river environment, in the commission's view and in staff's view, would also enhance water quality and dissolved oxygen. In the commission's view, taking all of these parts of the license together, not just the aeration system, but these other aspects as well, led it to believe, and also the fact that other agencies were in agreement that this standard was the appropriate one, led the commission to believe that this is an appropriate standard for now.
That standard revealed that, I think if I'm understanding you, the no diffuser option, or the no diffuser stage, 57.8% of the time at Logan Martin was going to drop below 4.0 during I'm only talking about during non-generation. 50% of the time at Leigh was going to go below 4 ml. 37% of the time at Neely was going to go below. And 11% of the time at Mitchell, it was going to go below. How is that remotely a sufficient determination that until they get around to the diffuser project, we're going to be able to safely maintain the 4 ml level of oxygen on this record? How is that supported by substantial evidence?
Well, I think that... in response to, I think those numbers came from a report from the company, I believe to FERC staff. Mm-hmm. And I think in response, FERC staff submitted a number of information requests to the company. So it's not as if the agency was doing
nothing. They may have asked, where is the information in the record that says that's inaccurate? In fact, even before the, even if without us knowing what the diffuser system is going to be, we are going to be able to be, maintain 4 ml as the level even during non-generation. Where is that evidence in the record? Because I really missed that.
But where is the evidence in the record that we would be able to maintain 4.0?
Yeah, with this new, more river, this river-like flow that you were talking about.
Sure. So that is in the, so for example, if we look at the rehearing order, that's JA-574.
Is that the first rehearing order?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's 574. There's also a number of places in the environmental assessment, but maybe we start with the rehearing order first.
Sorry, you said 574, right?
Oh, I apologize, Rhonda. That was actually the second rehearing order.
Sorry, which page of the JA are we in?
574. And this is paragraph 9.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's it's really the sort of middle of that paragraph. The commission concluded that the water quality certification's requirement for Alabama Power to maintain a minimum dissolved oxygen level of 4.0 milligrams per liter when the project is discharging, along with the other required dissolved oxygen and aquatic resource protections and water quality monitoring, will sufficiently protect aquatic resources.
That's a conclusion.
That's just stating what you needed to state. It doesn't set forth support.
And I think that's all predicated on Alabama Power doing what has yet to be determined it will do to improve oxygen levels during non-generation. That's the whole point here. Nobody knew what it was yet.
So I can also direct you to the to the environmental assessment as well.
Mm-hmm.
That has more information. There's a few different pages. 997 is the first one. There's also 1046 and 1084. Actually, you know, I think 1046 is probably the best place to start. That's the reference to the adaptive management plan. Actually, it's the first full paragraph on that page. This references the Weiss Bypass Adaptive Management Plan.
Does that apply to anything else other than Weiss?
There is another adaptive management plan for, I believe the Logan Martin development as well.
Okay, so we got Lay at 50% and Neely at 37%, right? Mitchell at 11%, so.
Right, I mean, I think.
I mean, Weiss was not one that seemed to have the problems or the worst statistical problems maintaining it during non-generation, so that's not a lot of help. You said you have a site where Logan takes care of this 57.8% failure rate?
So to be clear, I mean, I don't have a site that discusses that specific percentage of the dissolved oxygen falling below 4.0 and how the commission would address that. But what we have in the record is that, well, first of all, I mean, one point I'll make before all this is that certainly the commission has the ability to require additional protections. I think what the commission's trying to balance here is those various environmental concerns against all the other concerns that it's required to consider under the Federal Power Act, the need for the power, the costs of maintaining these systems, and so forth.
Yeah, where did you find that it would be too expensive to require a 4 ml level during non-generation?
It wasn't so much that it would be too expensive, but there was a finding that it would require additional costs.
Okay. I mean, sure. Everything costs something more. Is that so? If it costs a penny more, then we can go the desire, without Alabama Power Company saying or FERC finding that it would cost so much more that it would be damaging to the operation, it would impair the operation going forward or require reduced operation or something like that. You can just go, if it costs more, power wins. Is that what you just said?
No, that's not at all what I meant to
say.
So
then we need to know how much more it costs, and we don't know that in this record.
We do know that, actually. Okay. I can give you a site for
that. I don't even need like a dollar sign. I need a, I think, don't we need, and tell me if I'm wrong, don't we need the commission making a determination that requiring maintenance of that 4 mL level during non-generation will harm power production, that balancing, that it will cost X number and it's not worth it because. And I just didn't see that in the FERC.
I don't think that there's that discussion that, as you put it, requiring a standard during periods of non-generation will harm power production. I think what the commission did say is that there wasn't a demonstration that a higher standard was required. It was appropriate to use a standard that the other agencies had agreed with, and I think a big part of the
commission... Sorry, the other agencies... What other agency agreed that it would be okay to go below 4 mL 50% of the time?
Well, no agency agreed to that, but all of the agencies agreed with the commission's approach in the order to require 4.0 during periods of generation, with the caveat, as the commission put it in its orders, that to the extent that more was needed,
it could revisit the license. You're talking about during generation. I'm talking about during non-generation.
Right. I think we also have an indication on the record that the Alabama water quality certification applied only during periods of generation, not during periods when the project
does
not.
Does that absolve the?
That doesn't. Okay. Why is that conclusive? Because I don't think you're taking the position, or are you, that whenever a state has a particular baseline, then it's necessarily enough?
Okay. No. We're not taking that position at all. But I think that it's part of what the commission considered when it was going through the what it was required to do under NEPA and under the Federal Power Act to both evaluate these environmental concerns and appropriately balance these issues.
I'm hung up on your appropriately balanced, because that's usually in these cases, that's what we see. We'll go, okay, well, you know, of course this the Cadillac technology would get us up to 7 mL on oxygen, but it's prohibitively expensive, or it'll require some big machine that's gonna have these other adverse consequences. Or it's just too expensive, it's not worth it, or golly gee, that's too much oxygen, it's going to hurt some other species. What I didn't see in this whole decision was why you couldn't have required the more protective measures. For example, at a minimum, requiring 4 mL during non-generation, which was actually the commission's original requirement, and then they just dropped it to only during generation. I didn't see why the needs for generating power, why it wasn't technologically feasible, any of these things.
So that's a great question. I think that leads me to a point that I should have addressed earlier. The commission talked in the record about the practical difficulties of maintaining the dissolved oxygen standard, in part based on the fact that Alabama Power's essentially receiving these waters from upstream, and so it wouldn't be able to control the dissolved oxygen levels that it's receiving from some other development. That was part of the thinking here. The commission also...
I'm not sure I understand what... So does that mean they can't even keep it at 4 mL, even though that's what we require? Because then that doesn't marry well with your statement that, oh, no, what we did was say Alabama's got a plan, they're going to come back and tell us what the plan is, and they're going to put it in place, everything's going to be okay. That's very inconsistent with it's actually not doable here because there's just a chain of dams and power systems going up and down this river. That seems to be contradictory.
No, I think that my point on the upstream waters is that the commission was just emphasizing that there's practical limitations on the company's ability.
Well, presumably that's what the 4 mL represents, is the practical limitation.
No, I think actually the practical limitation was some higher standard than 4.0, and that's at 1045.
We're talking about not even maintaining 4.0. That's what we're talking about. So that wasn't a practical concern. That's what you required. You said during generation. And originally you said during non-generation, but then dropped that, and I just wasn't sure what happened.
Well, I think part of the reason that was dropped was that I think that was a recognition that that may have been a mistake, because it was trying to be consistent with what the Alabama certification was. And I think the commission, as I mentioned
before. Does Alabama law say you can go before low 4.0 ml during non-generation? I thought it said maintain 4.0 ml.
So what we have in the record is that the Alabama agency does not have regulatory authority to require a standard when a project is not generating.
And yeah, so but you do.
That's true, we do. But at the same time, as I mentioned before, I mean, the commission's ability to require more depends, it needs to be tempered by the fact that the commission has to balance a number of other considerations. The commission, I mean, the fact that dissolved oxygen may be dipping below 4.0 is something that the commission has the ability to address. As I mentioned, there are communications in the record where staff was requesting information from the licensee about what it could do to rectify that issue. Putting aside that sort of...
Well, you had conservation groups telling you what you could do to rectify that issue in this record, and you didn't say it wouldn't work.
Respectfully, Judge Millett, I think the commission did address all of the concerns and this specific argument raised by the conservation groups. What the commission's, I think I mentioned this before, but the part of the determination was the fact that it found that because it's monitoring, even though there's only a standard for dissolved oxygen during periods when the project is generating, the water quality monitoring is in effect at all times. So the commission has the ability to perceive when there's a problem. To the extent that conservation groups or anyone else thinks that there is a real issue, they can bring that to commission staff, and then commission staff can pursue that with the licensee. And obviously, the commission itself can reopen the license as needed in the future. The other agencies have the ability to come to the commission and ask that it reopen. But the ultimate biological opinion by Fish and Wildlife, because I think I mentioned the other agencies before, the ultimate conclusion was that the relicensing of a project, as long as the commission took into account a number of mitigation measures, would not jeopardize the existence of any species or critical habitat.
Any endangered species.
That's correct.
Threatened species.
That's correct.
Can you just give your quick synopsis on cumulative effects?
Sure.
And why the challenger's suggestion that you're not assessing cumulative effects properly is erroneous?
Sure. And I think what they said in their brief was that the commission failed to consider the past action being the construction and operation of the dams.
Right. As part of that. The existing status, the pre-new project status quo.
That's right. And so what the commission did actually address the operation and construction of the dams as part of its cumulative effects analysis in the environmental assessment. I can give you all sites, and then we can turn to the pages if that would be helpful. JA 1010 is one place we can start. There's also JA 1093, JA 1248, and JA 1250.
What did you say on 1010 and those others?
Yes, I'm about to pull that up. So this is in the paragraph labeled geographic scope, and this is under the cumulative effects section here. Looks like the second sentence. The construction and operation of dams in the Coosa River and Alabama River basins have cumulatively affected water quality, specifically DO concentrations and fish and mollusk populations in the basin. So that's one place that we have that discussion happening. We have similar language in the other pages that I referenced, including 1093 and 1248 and 1250. We can turn to those pages as well if you would like, but my point here is that it's not accurate to suggest that the commission's cumulative effects analysis did not consider this past action. I think we do need to consider what the commission also said about cumulative effects.
Surely,
generally,
surely its consideration means more than you put a sentence in our decision, which it has to be. Consideration means reflected analysis.
I think that
it could be enough if it just says we know we're supposed to take into account cumulative effects, and we've taken into account cumulative effects.
Well, I think that the cumulative effects discussion, I think as the commission pointed out, and it referenced one of this court's decisions, is that the commission can give a description of the current aggregate effects of past actions. It doesn't have to go into detail into specific historical details of any individual past action. And the regulation itself on cumulative effects states that there needs to be a description of the impact on the human environment that results from the incremental effects of the action when added to other past, present, and reasonably foreseeable future actions. So I don't think there needs to be some sort of breakdown of here's the effect based on the incremental effect when added to past actions, here's the incremental effect added to future actions, and so forth. It needs to be in the record. It needs to be reasonably addressed. And we have a number of places in the record where construction and operation was reasonably addressed. And this was not the only cumulative effects argument that was raised before the commission. Now, the construction and operation of the dams is the only issue on cumulative effects that was raised to this court. The commission also considered the location of other dams in the area, as well as climate change, as part of that cumulative effects analysis. So it's not accurate to say that this one sentence is the sum total of the cumulative effects analysis.
Not sure whether it's probably just my lack of understanding. I'm not even sure if everyone agrees on what they mean by considering the effects of past actions. So suppose before you ever had to make this relicensing decision, an original license from 1928 or something, and what was happening is as a result of that original licensing, not governed by any of these statutes, dissolved oxygen levels have been driven down to 3.8. And species are dying, including endangered species, are dying off at a rate of 10%. We'll just say there's goldenfish is dying off at 10% when it's 3.8. And now you come in for your licensing decision and for relicensing. And under the relicensing, you're going to continue at 3.8. And goldenfish is going to continue to die off at 10%, coming to full extinction at that 10% rate. That's going to lead to full extinction within the forthcoming 30-year period. Is your view that that's just not part of our analysis? That's just continuing what was happening before, and we don't have to deal with it at all? We don't have to address that problem at all? Or is your view, look, we're sorry you lost 50% of your goldenfish before. We can't deal with that. That was over and done by the time we came along. But going forward, under our license and our discretionary decision making, we, Alabama Power, we got to take ownership of goldenfish that die in the next 30 years, including the fact that if we don't do something about this oxygen level, they're going to go extinct.
So I think that, there's a couple of pieces there. First, mm-hmm. The commission, when it's considering this as part of a NEPA analysis, it certainly has to consider past effects as part of the cumulative effects analysis. And I think in that hypothetical, that's something that certainly would have to be considered.
Considered in what way? It has to be considered because it has to be referenced. But I think the point of the question is, what do you do with the fact that under the existing state of affairs, there's going to be continued depletion of the species? That seems like that's a strike against that has to be taken into account. Not just that, well, that's just the way things are right now, and therefore, although we're considering them in the sense that we're noting that that's going to continue to happen,
sure,
that's okay.
Sure, and I think that that gets to the second part of the answer, which is at the end of the day, FERC has to look to the expert agency, Fish and Wildlife, on issues related to the Endangered Species Act, and specifically the issue of the proper baseline.
Assume it's not endangered yet. I mean, it's going to be within the next 30 years at this 10% rate, but we're assuming it's just not there yet. So I don't want to divert over to that. I want to focus just on NEPA analysis, cumulative analysis.
So in other words, in this hypothetical, the species isn't quite endangered, but it's getting there.
Yeah, because it's dropping off at 10%. But boy, there were a lot to begin with.
I mean, I think that the commission would still have to take into account the judgment of Fish and Wildlife when it comes to species. But as far as NEPA, there needs to be a reasonable discussion in the commission record as to the cumulative effects. I couldn't say for certain.
Well, but the question we're ultimately trying to get to here is whether an EIS is required, right? I mean, ultimately, sure. If you look at the macro level, the point is that if there's a significant enough impact, then an EIS has to be put together, and an EA is not, an environmental assessment is not enough. And part of that analysis is, what's the cumulative impact?
Sure.
And when you're looking at cumulative impact, if you could say that carrying forward the existing state of affairs as it continues to deplete the species is not a significant impact because it's just part of what's already been going on, and therefore there's no EIS required, that's one thing. But if you would say that no, carrying forward the existing state of affairs continues to deplete the species, and that's part of the cumulative impact we need to take into account in determining whether an EIS is required, that seems like something else. And I thought the point of Judge Millett's question was, if you carry forward the existing state of affairs and it continues to result in depletion of the species, can the agency just say, well, that's not something that's significant in terms of cumulative impact because that's just status quo, and so no EIS is necessary? Or would you have to say, actually, depletion at a significant rate, let's leave aside endangerment, but depletion at a significant rate is a significant impact, and we need to take that into account in determining whether an EIS is required?
I think it's the latter, in that the commission, if the species is being depleted at that rate, it would necessarily have to be part of the consideration of whether there is a significant impact on species such that an environmental impact statement would be required.
Because I understood you to be making the other argument, that you were taking the former position in your, but maybe I misunderstood. I thought you were taking the former position in the brief, and that part of the reason that an EA is enough is because the analysis purposes, that prong of NEPA, we consider the going forward effects of the existing state of affairs as a given. But maybe I'm
only look at new effects, I think.
Is I'm that, sorry?
Yeah, you'd only look at new effects.
Right, you'd only look at new effects. You wouldn't.
I don't think we tried to take the position in our brief that you only consider new effects. I think what we tried to state in our brief is that the question on whether it was appropriate to just rely on an environmental assessment instead of an impact statement is whether any significant impacts or consequences are being ignored. Part of the difficulty here is there wasn't really a showing from petitioners that of the kind of hypothetical we've been talking about of a certain species being depleted at such a rate that that constituted some significant impact. So, but I don't think we tried.
That may be a better question for the FWS, but wasn't there a high likelihood of incidental take noted in the Fish and Wildlife Service's bio?
I'm sorry, what was the
high likelihood of incidental take? I think 100% maybe with respect to one species.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, I'd probably be best to let the DOJ's counsel cover the incidental take statement, but I think from FERC's perspective, if there's a concern about the species, it's obviously something that needs to be taken into account when you're considering whether there's a significant impact. What the commission did say is that there was not a showing that any species was in jeopardy as a result of the commission's relicensing decision, then obviously that was supported by the fact that Fish and Wildlife.
But they did find that at least the bull trout continues to remain in decline, and that it may not, it'll be moderated, so it might not decline right. So we might go now to, in my hypothetical, from 10% to 7%, but it was would continue to remain in decline and have negative population consequences. But I didn't see FERC addressing that. That's in the biological opinion, but I didn't see FERC addressing that. Continued decline.
I mean, so the environmental assessment contained a large section devoted to species. I can't standing here tell you where a specific species was discussed. I mean, we put in our brief the overall range of, it was something like at least 30 to 40 pages where this is discussed. What I'll say is that, I think I've mentioned this before, but under NEPA, the commission has to, its obligation is to adequately identify and evaluate the all the potential environmental impacts. In a circumstance like this one, where you have a fairly extensive environmental assessment, the question, I think, turns less on the issue of whether it should have been an impact statement or not, but was the commission's analysis grounded in the record per the substantial evidence standard, and did it engage in the appropriate balancing as it was required to do so under the Federal Power Act? The form of the document, I think, matters less. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll hear from Jerry now.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Alan Brabender on behalf of the Secretary of the Interior and the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. The Fish and Wildlife Service's role in this relicensing proceeding was that of a consulting agency under Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act. And its obligation was to analyze the action that FERC put before it and to analyze whether that particular action was likely to jeopardize an ESA-listed species or adversely modify the critical habitat of a listed species. And the action that FERC put before it proposed continuing current operations for 30 years into the future with modifications that were designed to be beneficial to species, such as dissolved oxygen enhancements, a new flow regime in the Weiss bypass, a shoreline management plan that is beneficial to species, a wildlife management plan that is beneficial to species, and a drought plan that is beneficial to species. Ultimately, the service concluded in the biological opinion that continuing operations, current operations 30 years into the future with these modifications, was not likely to jeopardize a species or adversely modify critical habitat. And in so concluding,
did the service explain the connection between the facts it found with reference to incidental take and the conclusion that they would not jeopardize?
Yes, I think the biological opinion as a whole does explain that. And it's because the take that was found is limited mostly to non-lethal harassment of individuals within the action area. And moreover, these individuals have been living under these conditions for decades.
Where is the best explanation of that in the opinion?
I think you'd have to draw from the opinion as a whole, Your Honor. You would have to first look to the baseline and look at the
You understand that it's the obligation of not just this agency, but all agencies to explain the connection between facts found and conclusion reached.
In a way that we can see.
That's true. But I think this court needs to look at the record as a whole and the biological opinion as a whole. And there is more than sufficient information in the biological opinion to explain the Fish and Wildlife Service's opinion, including the baseline, where the species are located, the factors that are affecting them, and what this particular action does, which is continue operations into the future with the same impacts, but with the addition of modifications that are beneficial to the species. And again, the take that is predicted by the service is mostly non-lethal take, where these species have been living with this sort of harassment for decades.
Well, it's not directly lethal, but the definition of harm is a likelihood, right, as opposed to actual killing. So there's going to be, anytime you have 100% level in a certain area of harm, harassment, you're really going to have some that die as well, right?
Well,
you find that actually no one is going to die. No member of the species is going to die from this harassment. We're certain of that.
As a result, yes, that would be the conclusion from the Fish and Wildlife Service. 100% harassment for continuing operations at the Logan Martin Dam, for instance, which is the one dam where there are ESA-listed species in the vicinity. The other location where there are ESA-listed species is in the Weiss Bypass. And what this action does is impose a new minimum flow regime for the first time that will be beneficial to the species. Now, with respect to the take for that one particular action, what the service predicted was that there would be 90% harassment, 10% harm to the sensitive individuals of the species. But of course, there was mitigation put in place because the harm was going to come through higher water temperatures on that one-time release for a few days after the release. but there were mitigation measures put in place to monitor the
water. One time in 30 years?
One time in the 30-year term of the license, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. And there were mitigation measures put in place to make sure that those higher water temperatures wouldn't result in the predicted harm. And I think, more importantly, with respect to this particular action, that one-time release of water occurred in 2014, and therefore this particular provision is no longer operative, is no longer in effect, it's perhaps moot. And again, the only other place where we're talking about ESA listed species in the vicinity is below or in the vicinity of Logan Martin Dam, which is also an area known as Lay Lake.
So if dissolved oxygen levels Logan Dam are below 4 ml, 57% of the non-generation time, what are the consequences of that for the species, for the endangered species in that area?
Well, and of course, species have been living under these conditions for decades, and they're still found there. But that being said, the service did consider it to be a big issue, the issue of...
What do you mean a big issue?
The issue of dissolved oxygen levels during non-generation periods. Mm-hmm. And the service did express concern that the water quality certificate from the state of Alabama didn't address the issue. Mm-hmm. But the service did address the issue. It made recommendations to FERC to monitor water quality during non-generation periods and to require Alabama Power to come up with a plan to address dissolved oxygen issues during non-generation
periods.
Before
the license issues.
Pardon?
A plan should be in place before the license issues? Or is it okay to wait a couple of years for a plan to come in place? Would that not jeopardize the
Well, again,
species?
the service's obligation here is only that of a consulting agency. It can only make recommendations.
I'm just on your judgment about the jeopardy to the endangered species in this area.
And again, we have to consider both the fact that these species have been living with these dissolved oxygen levels for decades during non-generation periods. This action improves dissolved oxygen and tries to enhance dissolved oxygen period during generation periods, which could have some
kills
impact.
Kills them less slowly? That counts? We're killing them more slowly.
And then that moves to the other point, which is the type of take that is predicted in the tail race for Logan Martin is harassment, non-lethal take.
Were you considering the dissolved oxygen levels during that? Did you factor into that? Factoring also that not just this one-time dump, but also the dissolved oxygen levels.
Of course,
the
service fully considered the issue of dissolved oxygen, and it also has to be
the two together. What I'm saying.
Well, yes, it considered during generation periods, and it also made recommendations to bring levels to satisfy the 4.0 standard during non-generation periods, which is a requirement that FERC did include in the license at JA 155. But with respect to jeopardy, again, not only does the fact that it's only non-lethal harassment being predicted, but it also has to be considered that these populations, these individuals, are only a very small percentage of the population as a whole. And the Fish and Wildlife Services...
In that area? In that?
No, in the United States as a whole. And that's this,
yeah, well,
the service makes population level.
We care for endangered species about presence within a range. So is it okay to say we're going to render the species extinct in the Coosa River as long as there's enough elsewhere in the country? I would have thought that was jeopardy.
I mean, that under certain circumstances that could be true. But of course that's not.
Well,
that's
this is part of this is a range, so it's okay to just extinct. That wouldn't be jeopardy to render them extinct in this range?
That would be true because it's that population.
I'm sorry, that would be true. It would not be jeopardy.
It would not necessarily be jeopardy. Of course, it depends on the facts. But the service's analysis pertains to the population as a whole, not in this particular area. That is the analysis that's required under the ESA. It's a population level.
I could have sworn the ESA also looked at the presence of species within their range.
Well, there's something called a distinct population segment, but there is these, as far as I know, these particular species are not in distinct populations.
Is that all explained in the biological opinion? Everything you just told Judge Millett, is that all in there?
Well, certainly the type of take that the small percentage of the population as a whole, certainly that is in the biological opinion. The fact that the service has to take a species level look, that is also in the biological opinion.
Do you know what percent of the time it's these turbines are generating, what percentage of the time they're not generating? So how much time are we not at 4 mL?
Well, so there are 7 different developments on the river, and I believe Weiss, Neely, Henry, and Logan Martin are the only, I forget the proper term, but they're the only ones that generate intermittently.
Mm-hmm.
1 to 6 hours a day is my understanding. The rest of the
development. 1 to 6 is when they are generating?
Correct. They during early morning hours and evening hours during peak times is my understanding.
So they may not even be doing that every day?
It's Monday through Friday.
Okay. So the overwhelming majority of the time is non-generation as to those places that you specified?
That's correct. And the other developments are run-of-the-river developments, otherwise the river just runs through them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can I ask you a question about the baseline, your conceptual understanding of the baseline? So in a situation in which the existing status quo would, not taking into account relicensing just under the existing state of affairs, would cause a continued depletion of a species at a particular rate, are you considering that continued depletion under the existing state of affairs to be part of the baseline?
What the service would consider was that continuing depletion into the future, yes. And certainly that is what...
Yeah, the continued depletion into the future would be part of the baseline?
No, that would be an effect of the action, Your Honor.
Oh, because I thought I understood you to be making the other. Maybe I just completely misunderstood your argument, but I had the same question for FERC, but I understood you to be making the argument that under the existing state of affairs, continued depletion of the species would be part of the baseline, so you wouldn't take that into account in determining what the incremental effect of the new project would be.
Well,
but maybe I may be completely off on this.
I mean, certainly that
I read it that way too, for what it's worth, but that may just mean I'm off base too.
You got it the same way that, yeah.
Well, I mean, certainly the environmental factors and the current impacts are considered as part of the baseline, but going forward,
right,
the project operations are considered an effect of the action.
No, but I get that, but that's just saying it at a high level of generality. I'm just saying that suppose you have an existing project that results in a 10%, make it more concrete than that, 100 snails die each year from an existing project, and then we're considering relicensing of a project with some new conditions. Are we saying that the additional 100 that would continue to die each year under the existing state of affairs is just part of the baseline? It's going to happen in the future.
Mm-hmm.
It would continue happening in the future if we kept things the same way. But it's an additional depletion of 100 snails per year going into the future. Are you taking that as part of the baseline, or are you saying that's an effect?
Well, let me put it this way, because you know whether something belongs in the baseline or is an effect of the action is somewhat hazy, I would say. But what the service does is it aggregates the two. It looks at the baseline and it adds to the baseline the effects of the action. So no matter what in that situation, that fact would be taken into consideration by the service in making its jeopardy determination. And the operations going forward into the future were considered by the service in
it's, it
this.
Seems surpri- it, I guess conceptually it seems like it would be important, and it's surprising to me that it wouldn't be important, because the administrative materials that the agency has goes to some trouble to explain what properly belongs in the baseline and what doesn't,
mm-hmm.
presumably because that is of some consequence. And I guess it's surprising to me to hear that it actually doesn't end up mattering whether you consider it in the baseline or consider it in the effects, because it all's taken into consideration anyway. Is that true that it doesn't? I'm not necessarily saying that's wrong.
Well, I'm saying that the handbook goes into some detail as to what is considered in the baseline and what's considered in the effects, because that's how the ESA itself structures the analysis. But as a practical matter, because it's going to be either considered, the impact is either going to be considered as part of the baseline, or as part of the effects of the action. And those two things are considered in the aggregate when making a jeopardy determination. In practicality, it doesn't matter. And here, the service did consider current operations going forward. I would refer the court to JA 1496, which is the conclusion in the biological opinion, where it notes that it considered both current and proposed future operations and their impact. And JA 1498, which is the incidental take statement, I think provides further evidence that existing impacts were considered, since it provides take coverage for current operations going forward into the future. And you can see that at actions 1B and 1C, the Logan Martin Dam and the Jordan Dam.
How do we know when too many have been taken?
I think that's a fact-specific inquiry.
Under this opinion, how will we know when too many have been taken? Some of the argument is we can't figure out how to count them.
Well, the service knows where these species are located. And again, the type of take predicted is just harassment. And harassment.
That's predicted, but the whole point of incidental take is recognize this could happen, but if more happens than we expect,
then
we have to be able to revisit this.
That's right. And
has to be a concrete trigger, normally either counting the species, or if you can't, having some sort of habitat alteration proxy. And I just wasn't clear here how anyone was supposed to know when
sure.
The incidental take was off.
So with respect to the incidental take statement, where the service had population data, it expressed take in forms of a specific number. So there's a specific numeric trigger. But the service explained that for many of the species, it lacked population density data. And so what it did there for purposes of the jeopardy analysis is it conservatively assumed that 100% of the species in the action, of the individuals in the action area would be affected. And so by definition, you cannot exceed the level of 100%. So there'd be no reason to reinitiate consultation based on the number of individuals affected alone.
If you can't count them, though, how will you know if, in fact, what if you're wrong and, in fact, 50% die and 50% are harassed but survive? How will that be?
Well, that goes to my next point, which is just because the take statement is also clear that just you have to reinitiate consultation, not only if the amount of take is exceeded, but also the extent of take. So for the most part, only non-lethal harassment is predicted. Harm is either not predicted at all or predicted only in a very specific situation, like the Weiss bypass example I gave earlier. So if take ended up being different from what was predicted, if these species were killed instead of harassed, that would require a reinitiation of consultation on the part of FERC.
My question is really more basic than that. Given that you said we can't count, how will anyone know?
Well, the service actually knows where the species are located and provided a specific, they know exactly where the species are located, and they gave a trigger for the reinitiation of consultation with respect to the extent of the take.
And what's the trigger?
With respect to 100, the species are being harassed, and if the extent of take is greater or different than mere harassment, which is non-lethal, then that would require additional consultation.
You had just said that the reason we couldn't do numeric numbers like we often do because we just couldn't, as to these teensy-weensy little mussels, we just can't count them. We may know where they are, we know they're in there, but we can't count them. So no one's going to know if 50% die off, are they? Don't you need a habitat marker of some sort?
Well, they wouldn't know under a habitat marker either if nobody can detect the take.
So then what's the point of your incidental take statement if no one can tell if it's right or wrong?
Well, it is a requirement of the ESA to have
a pretty empty exercise. We think 100% will get hurt, but we have no way of knowing if 100% will die.
Well, there is ongoing monitoring required under the license, it's my understanding. And again, to the extent that or the conservation groups, for their part, could also go
ongoing investigate. Monitoring of what?
Of project operations. And to the extent, you know, the conservation groups could also go out and monitor. Thank you.
Thank you. Given how long we've gone, we'll give you 4 minutes back for rebuttal to address what you need to address, please.
I want to begin just by responding to Judge Millett's question that I did not have a record site for. Mm-hmm. The dissolved oxygen levels at some of these dams drop as low as 0.1 milligrams per liter. If you look at Joint Appendix page 1534, so that is incredibly low and not
what's
sufficient.
What's the site for that, JA what?
JA
1534. Do you agree with the statement about the ratio of generating to non-generating time?
Yes, at the peaking dams, the license says it'll be 1 to 6 hours Monday through Friday, so with the vast majority of the time it's not generating and there's no standard whatsoever. I want to address first one of the last points made by the Fish and Wildlife Service. We do not see the incidental take statement as a requirement that is some sort of incidental or empty exercise that only needs to be done to comply with the statute. It is a critical part of keeping these species alive, and it is a critical part of the doctrine of institutionalized caution, which is the purpose of the Endangered Species Act. Also want to address a couple of the points.
What should they do if they can't count them? These things are too teeny to count. What should they do? How would they know? Is there a way that they, were they wrong when they said there's no way to know whether in fact the incidental take here was exceeded or different than predicted, materially different than predicted?
We think that's the precise problem, is there isn't a way to know here whether the incidental take statement was exceeded, and that's why it doesn't meet the surrogate regulations. Critical to the concept of an incidental take statement is to know when that incidental take is exceeded. I don't think it's true that you can't always have a number for these species. The Tolotoma snail, for example, they give a very specific number. It's 5,000 and a certain hundred. And so it's not impossible to know how many of these species are out there. But it does allow for, the regulations do allow for surrogates, but you have to use those surrogates properly, and they haven't done that here. I also want to address the point that the majority of the take here is non-lethal harassment. I believe they said the only place that you have harm is in the Weiss Bypass. That's not accurate. One example of that is the harm from the drawdown of Lay Lake. They discussed the fact on JA 1500 that there will be harm to the rough horn snail. This is a species, the Yellowleaf Creek portion of Lay Lake has 80% of the species range. The rough horn snail is only found in a couple of locations anywhere. 80% of its range is here. They discussed the fact that there may be harm or harassment. And so that's critical. But even where there is non-lethal harassment, the definition of harassment is you have to injure a species to such an extent that you disrupt their breeding and their feeding. When we're talking about endangered species, issues like can they reproduce are critically important to the continued success. Going back momentarily to the baseline issue, I just want to highlight the fact that here, the existing
condition. Just 1 second, sir. Where does that definition of harass come from?
It should come from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service regulations, and I don't have the citation, but I believe it is in their brief.
The definition of take is statutory, but I'm not sure where. But okay, I'll take. There's a lot of words here, and I'll take your brief. Word for it. Okay. I'm sorry, I took you off your plate. You say go ahead.
You were saying something about baseline, I think.
Yes, going back to the baseline issue, I just want to highlight that moving forward, again, the operation of these dams, the existing conditions going forward are only going to be existing because of the affirmative decisions made in this license. And so it very much has to be considered as an effect under NEPA and as an effect of the action under the Endangered Species Act. And finally, just to very briefly conclude, going back to the standard under NEPA, the real question here before the court for the NEPA question is, may there be significant impacts? And we are talking about seven dams, over 275 miles of river. Operating these dams in the past has caused the extinction or extirpation of nearly 40 species. It has brought many more species to the brink of extinction. And the commission's position is, but going forward, there won't be any more significant impacts. Your Honors, that is the definition of arbitrary and capricious, and that is why we would ask that the court vacate the finding of no significant impact and vacate the biological opinion. and remand this to the agencies to do the full and statutorily required inquiries.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsels. Case is submitted.